So, hello everyone. We are within striking distance of Purim, and I wanted to devote both this week and next week to matters of Purim, and to begin this evening by taking a look at Megillas Esther. We're all familiar with the psukim of the Megillah, certainly with the story. I'm not sure that hearing the Megillah on Purim is the best time to contemplate it deeply. Any deeper contemplative thoughts tend to be shredded periodically by all manner of noise-making instruments. So that it certainly behooves us to take a good look and get a good appreciation of the Megillah well in advance. The Perush that we will be basing ourselves on is the Perush Yosef Lekach of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, one of the great early Acharonim. And it really is a classic Perush, tribute, I would say, to the significance of this commentary on the Megillah is the fact that many classic commentaries, including those of the Vilna Gaon and the Malbim, base themselves significantly on the Yosef Lekach. So Haskomas don't get better than that. And the first two chapters of Megillas Esther are of particular significance, specifically because it's very easy to tell the story of Purim or the miracle of Purim without them. Indeed, in the Al HaNisim prayer, which we add on Purim, we basically start from when Haman joins, which is chapter 3. One could almost see the first two chapters as prehistory. And yet, in many respects, they are crucial, perhaps the most significant chapters. And the reason why is because if we were to summarize or synopsize the miracle of the Purim story, it really is about the right people being in the right place at the right time. Esther's the queen, Mordechai's on location, and it was just a question of mobilizing. The big miracle comes when we appreciate what it took to get the right people into the right place at the right time. How did Esther come to be queen? How does Mordechai come to be on location? And those are ideas that we glean from the first two chapters. And we'll take a look at the first chapter this evening. If you have a Megillas Esther handy, of course, recommended to follow inside. Otherwise, I think we're familiar enough with the psukim, worst case scenario, act casual, and we'll discuss as we go along. Megillas Esther begins with a party. Two parties, in fact. And the pasuk doesn't really explicate what the parties were about. In other words, pasuk Beis simply tells us in the third year of his reign, Achashverosh makes a feast. What's the background to the feast? Al derech ha-pshat. Well, Yosef Lekach, like others, explain as follows. As we know, in the sequence of empires, Persia was preceded by Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar and his family, his son and grandson. And then Babel was taken over by Paras, by Daryavish, and so on and so forth. But the king Belshazzar of Babel was conquered by Daryavish. And now Persia is in charge. Important to realize that even as Persia took over as being in charge of the world, of running the world, they continued to run it from Babel. In other words, the infrastructure was set up for Babel to be the center of world operations. As much as Persia is now in charge, they are in charge, but they're in charge from Babel. There's an existing infrastructure. The development of Achashverosh's time is that he made the decision to move the center of world operations back to Persia, as if to say, if Persia is in charge, let the world be run from Persia. And this took place in the third year of his reign. And this is the background to the parties. As we know, the first party is 180 days long, which is a long time. And that is for the nobles. What is the point? The point is, this party, these 180 days, are there to establish Shushan HaBira as the place to go to and to go from. In other words, to habituate the nobles of all of the provinces, this is where they check in. This is where they come back to, report back to. This is now the center. And therefore, these 6 months were training, in a sense, of the world provinces to recognize Shushan as the place, as the go-to place. After that, Ahasuerus has his Haftorah party, where the 7 days, and the 7 days is for everyone in Shushan. Once again, the point is to establish Shushan as being important. If you live in Shushan, you're invited to the king's party. All of this is to establish Shushan now as the center of the world. Why does Ahasuerus choose to move the center of world operations from Babel to Persia? That we'll have to see. But this already introduces us to element number one of the miracle of Purim. How so? Because one of the two prime heroes of the story is Mordechai. Mordechai lives in Shushan. Prior to this event, prior to Ahasuerus moving everything, Shushan was a place of no particular significance. But now it's the center of the world. Which means that as much as when the time comes, Mordechai will be on location to act for the benefit of the Jewish people, he's on location because location was on him. In other words, Mordechai is there first, and then the center of the world moves to him, which is good service by anyone's standards. And that, says Yosef Lekach, is the full impact of the verse that we, it's one of the verses that we all say aloud in the second parak. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. That doesn't sound like a big chiddush. There was a Jew in Shushan HaBira. Shushan is the capital city. We shouldn't be surprised if there's Jews there. It's like saying there was a Jew in Washington, D.C. It's not a chiddush. The point is, Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. The word haya doesn't mean it was, it's a past perfect. He already was there. Mordechai was there before Ahasuerus came along. And that really is the full impact of this idea. And so Ahasuerus makes his party. There is extensive description of the decor of these parties, certainly an elaborate affair. And then something happens. In Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. And let's see. Bayom Hashvi'i Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. On the 7th day of the second party, the king is merry with wine, and he tells his servants, Mehuman, Bizasar, Chavona, etc. And what does he tell them to do? Pasuk Yud Aleph, Lahavies Vashti'a Malkalef Ne'a Melech Becheser Malchus, to bring Vashti. Because as we know, Vashti was also there with her own party to bring her before the king. La'aros ha'amim la'asarim es yafya ki tovas mar'ehi, to show everyone how beautiful she was. Vashti, as we know, declined. There's all sorts of reasons, starting with Chazal. Everyone knows Vashti was having a bad horn day that day. But through the pshat, we'll see if we can see something else. It's interesting to note, firstly, how is Vashti referred to in these psukim? Because sometimes she's called Vashti Hamalka, Vashti the queen, which she is. On other occasions, she's called Hamalka Vashti, Queen Vashti, which she is. So she is both Vashti Hamalka and Hamalka Vashti. But if they're the same, what's behind the reversal? In Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, Lahavi es Vashti Hamalka, to bring Vashti the queen before him. But in Pasuk Yud Beis, it says, Vatimain Hamalka Vashti. So what is behind the shift of Vashti Hamalka versus Hamalka Vashti? It's also interesting that Ahasuerus, as we know, is furious when she doesn't turn up. He's made a big show, his wife is going to come, she doesn't turn up. And how is his anger described in the Pasuk? Actually, it's described in two ways. In the end of Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayiktsof HaMelech Ma'od, which we would translate as the king was very angry, V'chamasa Barabo, and his anger boiled within him, burned within him. But what is the difference between Vayiktsof HaMelech and V'chamasa Barabo? I mean, how many types of anger are there? And if there's more than one type, why do we see them both with Ahasuerus? We need to appreciate, says Yosef Lekach, that there is some degree of tension between Ahasuerus and Vashti. I mean, theirs was a match that was based on considerations from both sides. What is the difference between them? Vashti is descended from royalty. It's yesterday's royalty, but yesterday's royalty is also royalty. She is a great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and she has blue blood. Ahasuerus is what they would call new money. He started at the bottom. I'd say he worked his way up. More correctly, he killed his way up. He started as the stable boy in the empire of Bavel. And then he worked his way up. He's come a long way since then. In fact, I think it is a very apt description of Ahasuerus generally to say that he was far from stable. But certainly, career-wise, he's come a long way. And the two got married. And now the question is, who is the real power here? Who is the real center? Is it Vashti, who brings the royalty to the table? Is it Ahasuerus, who brings the power to the table? So as we can appreciate, this is a matter which is a subject of a Machlokas Rishonim, specifically between Ahasuerus and Vashti. And this is how the dinner conversation would tend to go. And Ahasuerus says to Vashti, you'd be nothing without me. No one would know for you. You'd be history. You're only current because of me. And she says to him, you'd be nothing without me. No one would take you seriously. I give you respectability. And that's the way it goes. All of this will give us a much deeper insight into another party that was taking place parallel to Ahasuerus's party. And that was the one that Vashti made. In Pasuk Tes, it says, Gam Vashti Hamalka, Ososo Mishtenoshim. Vashti also made a party for the women folk. Beis Hamalchus Asher LaMelech Ahasuerus in the royal palace. I think we might be inclined to understand that Vashti here was entertaining the Rebbetzins while he's making a party for the menfolk, she's making for the womenfolk, dutiful wife that she is, and it's all wonderful. That's not what's happening. Ahasuerus has moved from Bavel to Persia in order to establish himself as the primary one in this couple. And that is part of what prompted his decision. In other words, because there's this ongoing competition, you could say, between him and Vashti, who is the ikker? Who's primary? It's very difficult to be primary if you're living in the country where the other person lives. It's like if you'd be working for his father-in-law and living in his basement, it's difficult to establish himself as primary. But that's conceptually the situation, as long as he's in Bavel. And that's why Ahasuerus is looking to bring everything over to Persia, new location, home location, to establish him as a Persian as the Ikar. But we can appreciate Vashti has plans of her own, which means that when he's making his party to establish himself in Shushan, Vashti is making a counterparty to establish herself in Shushan. It's very interesting. Politics ever since then has really been about clash of parties, but never in this way. This was literally a machlokas between the two parties. And that's really the emphasis of Gam Vashti Hamalka. He made a party, and she Oichet made a party. And he's establishing himself, and she is establishing herself. And what's very interesting is there is one detail that we're told about the party. We get a lot of details about Achashverosh. We know what the decor was like. We get the whole spread. But when it comes to Vashti, we're told one thing. Gam Vashti Amalka, she made a party for the women. We're told where it was. Beis Hamalchus, in the royal palace. What is the significance of that? Where is Achashverosh at the time? Well, he took his party into the courtyard as an expansive move. However, that turned out to be an error, because in taking his party out to the courtyard, he left the palace empty. It doesn't do to leave a palace unattended, because it then became occupied by Vashti and her party. And the palace, of course, is the center, as if to say what Vashti is doing is, it's a coup of sorts. She's saying, you can take the menfolk outside and we will be inside where the power really is. All of this will give us to understand how, before the party is out, someone will have to emerge as primary. Otherwise, Achashverosh will not have succeeded. And therefore, what's behind the calling of Vashti to his party means that it needs to be established who comes to whom. And this is something that Achashverosh, he's working himself up for, and he does this at the end of the second party. And what's very interesting is, and this Rav Soloveitchik points out, there is a volume on Chanukah and Purim called the Alachuot, and it's a wonderful observation. This is the second of Achashverosh's parties. The first one is 180 days. He has ample opportunity to call for Vashti during that party, but he doesn't. It's only at the end of the second party that he calls for Vashti. Why? Says Rav Soloveitchik, because who are the two parties for? The first party is for the nobility. Achashverosh doesn't want Vashti present when the nobility are there, because his whole goal in calling her is to show that she's secondary. But she has much more in common with the nobility than he does. And you can envisage a nightmare situation. She'll come to the first party, their nobility, she's nobility, he's low level, and she's going to spend the evening reminiscing with all the noblemen, how they used to play polo and take tea on the lawn. And Achashverosh will be phased out. Achashverosh doesn't know how to hold a teacup. He'd probably break it. He doesn't want her in a situation where she will feel more at home than he does. And therefore, he waits until the second party. And the second party is full of Amcha. And Achashverosh is the king of Amcha. Everyone who's there. It's a much lower... It's the commoners. And Vashti will feel out of place. That's why he waits for the second party. Classic observation from Rav Soloveitchik. And this is what's behind the two expressions that we call Vashti Hamalka and Hamalka Vashti. In other words, these two expressions demonstrate the differing views of Achashverosh and Vashti. As far as Achashverosh is concerned, her name is Vashti Hamalka, as if to say she was Vashti before she was queen, because she was Vashti, which is a nobody, and then she married me, and that's how she became the queen. Vashti, of course, sees things completely opposite. She sees herself as Hamalka Vashti, as if to say she was queen before she was Vashti, because her royalty predated her. It's in her roots. It didn't come from her marriage. It's not something she attained. It's something she was born into. And that is why in Pasuk Yud Aleph, when he says to call her, he says to Lehavi es Vashti Hamalka, call Vashti who became queen when she married me. But when Vashti refuses, she doesn't just say no. She says two things. Number one, no. And number two, and don't call me Vashti Hamalka. Vatima'ein Hamalka Vashti. I'm the queen. I was queen before I was Vashti. And that's my background. And I'm primary here. So it turns out that Vashti's refusal has two elements to it. One of which is apparent to all. Namely, she was summoned and she didn't come. That was a big, great expectations in the men's party and she didn't come. But secondly, the insult that she added. I'm Hamalka Vashti and you're a nobody. That's why the Gemara says that she said the stable boy of my grandfather is not going to tell me what to do. It's where is it alluded to in the verse? When it calls her Hamalka Vashti. I'm the Malka. So her response is twofold, the refusal to come and the insult to boot. The difference between them is her refusal is manifest to all. But her insult, of course, is not well known. That was communicated privately to Ahasuerus, probably by some very nervous courtiers. And that is why Ahasuerus's response is twofold. Two types of anger. One is called Ketzef, Vayiktsof HaMelech Ma'od, and one is called Chema, V'chamoso Bo'arabo. What is the difference between Ketzef and Chema? Well, as Mefarshim point out, Ketzef, which literally means foam, in other words, it refers to a person visibly showing signs of anger, whether they're literally frothing at the mouth or quaking or whatever it is. You can see they're visibly angry. One aspect of Ahasuerus' anger was visible because the extent to which everyone knew and was expecting Vashti and she doesn't turn up, so he is visibly angry about that. But there's a second element, that insult, that she's the queen and he's the nobody, he's the commoner, that's not well known in his party. That Ahasuerus keeps to himself. V'chamoso bo'ara bo. That wrath seeds within him. And therefore Ahasuerus is really not in a good place at the moment. And now the question arises, the question beckons, what to do with Vashti? So let's see who Ahasuerus consults. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer HaMelech LaChachamim Yodei HaItim, the king says to his wise men, to those who know the time, Ki chein dvar HaMelech, for thus is the matter of the king, Lifnei Kol Yodei Das Vadin, before those who know constitution and law. Das, actually, does not mean religion. Das means constitution. Das what it. So, we see a number of different qualifications here. People who know the times. What is the significance of people who know the times? Yodei ha'itim. And are they the same as those who are yodei das vadin? Who know constitution and law? Is it the same people? Are they different groups of people? In Pasuk Yud Dalet, we find seven additional people, Karshana Shesar, Master Tarshis, Meris Marsana Memuchan. And who are they? Well, what does it say about them? They are Shivas Sarei Parasumadai, noblemen, Ra'ei Pnei HaMelech, they see the king, Hayoshvi Mershona Bamalchus. They sit first in the kingdom. We have before us about five different types of qualifications. And the question is, what exactly is Ahasuerus? Who is he turning to, and what does he want? Says Yosef Lekach, For a private citizen, if a person has a legal problem, he naturally needs to seek a legal solution. And the people to go to for a legal solution are those who know Das Vadin. They know the Constitution and they know the law. However, if you're a king, it's not so simple. The pure, correct, legal solution is not always the right move for a king. There are sometimes overriding concerns, political concerns, and therefore, for the king, he first needs to consult with another group of people, and they are called Yodei Ha'itim, people who know the times. They know the times in which they live, they know the currents, they know the feelings, they know the moods, and that's why the first people you consult with are, if we look again at the Pasuk Yud Gimel, he speaks to Chachamim Yodei Ha'itim, wise men, people who know the time. Kichein Devar HaMelech, for that is the way the king needs to act. Lifnei Kol Yodei Das Vadin. Lifnei, before, means he needs to consult with group one, Yodei Ha'itim, before group two, which is Yodei Das Vadin. And this brings us to a very important point. Namely, that Ahasuerus does not want to kill Vashti. And the reason is very simple. The reason he doesn't want to kill her is the reason he married her. He recognizes that he does need her. And in fact, according to the Alshich, when the Pasuk says that he was furious by Yiktsof HaMelech, and then says V'chamaso bar abo, so we translate V'chamaso bar abo, his wrath burned within him. But the Alshich says V'chamaso bar abo, his anger burned at him. In other words, he was furious at himself. He's furious at her for saying no, but he's second in line, he's furious at himself. How could I have gotten myself into this situation? I need to get out of it. Because the truth is, she does bring that nobility and respectability to the union. And therefore, if we look closely at Pasuk Tesvav, we'll see some interesting things. Firstly, Kedas Malasos Bamalka Vashti. In these few words, we already see that Ahasuerus does not wish to kill her. Firstly, amazingly, he calls her Malka Vashti. Now, we've already seen that Hamalka Vashti means that she really is queen, as if to say she brings the nobility to the table. He never will call her to her face Hamalka Vashti. When he sent for her, he sent for her as Vashti Hamalka. She countered that she's Hamalka Vashti. It's true. He'll never say it, he'll never admit it to her. But as he's talking to this tribunal now, he has to recognize she really is Hamalka Vashti. That's the truth. Don't tell her I said so, but it's the truth. And that's why he says, Kedas Malasos Bamalka Vashti. What should we do with Vashti? Killing someone is not something you do with them. It's what you do to them. It doesn't say Malasos Lamalka Vashti. It says Bamalka Vashti. What should we do with her? In other words, he wants to keep her in play. Maybe somehow to censure her, if possible, but not to eliminate her. Even though that's what the law dictates. But that's why we've already seen Ahasuerus isn't looking for a legal situation. He's looking for a way out of this situation. And that's why the first word in the Pasuk is Kedas. Das is constitution and law. The letter kaf means like, approximate. He's not looking for a legal solution. He's looking for something which is like a legal solution. Legal style. Kedas. In order to save face, but also to save Vashti. And what's also very interesting is, again, the closer we look at the words, the more you see. Because how does he describe her crime in Pasuk Tesvav? Ala shelo asusa es ma'amar hamelech Achashverosh. We need to do something because she didn't fulfill ma'amar hamelech Achashverosh. Actually, when the pasuk earlier describes her refusal, it doesn't describe her refusing ma'amar hamelech Achashverosh. Pasuk Yud Bey says, Vatama'in hamalka vashti, she refused lavo bidvar hamelech. In actual fact, his message to her was called Devar HaMelech. When he now rephrases what happened, he calls it Ma'amar HaMelech. What is the difference between Devar HaMelech and Ma'amar HaMelech? Well, as we know, Rashi tells us on numerous occasions, the difference in connotation between Dibur and Amira is that Dibur has a relatively more harsh connotation. Dibur is Loshon Kosher. Dibur would be an order. Ma'amar is a softer intonation. Amira Raka. And we see what Achashverosh is doing is that he's retelling what happened in a way which lessens the offense. In reality, he sent her an order, Dvar HaMelech, and she refused. But now when Achashverosh is now reviewing the whole thing, he frames it not as Dvar HaMelech, but Ma'amar HaMelech, as if to say, listen, I never actually told her she has to come. If I had commanded her to come, that would be a terrible and unpardonable thing. It was never Dvar HaMelech, it was Ma'amar HaMelech. It was a suggestion, a thought, okay, she's not too busy, or feels like a change, and in the end it didn't work out for her, but it was never more than a ma'amar. That's not true. But this is how Achashverosh is looking to reframe it in order to lessen the offense. And moreover, he says, she didn't fulfill ma'amar ha-melech Achashverosh biyad hasarisim. That it was communicated through the stewards. And again, what Achashverosh means to imply is, she never defied me directly. She never said no to my face. Who did she say no to? The help. Okay, well, you know, she's a noble person. She gets a bit uppity. Maybe they spoke to her the wrong way. Biyad hasarisim, the way that she acted vis-a-vis the servants. Well, you know, that maybe they just they said it wrong or whatever it might be. And these, therefore, are the themes that give us to understand that as much as Achashverosh is very upset with Vashti, he doesn't want to kill her. And why is it important to recognize this? Because this will then give us a deeper appreciation of the fact that in the end he did kill her. Even though he didn't want to, no one wanted to advise him to do that. And in the end he did it anyway, at the instigation of one person. And as a result of that, place was cleared for Esther to become queen when the time came. And this person is Memuchan. Memuchan, who speaks up, and as we know, the Gemara tells us, Memuchan is Haman. He's called Memuchan because he's ready for disaster. He's prepared for disaster. And therefore, even though no one wants to kill Vashti, Memuchan makes the plea to kill Vashti, and thus clears a space for Esther. What's really fascinating to consider is that the Jewish people are currently getting themselves deeper and deeper into trouble at this party. But at the very party where they're incriminating themselves, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is already preparing the way for their salvation when the time comes and when they get themselves together. So they're busy getting themselves more and more into trouble, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is busy organizing that solution will be on hand, and it's all happening simultaneously. And there's something else we need to know about Memuchan. He belongs to a third group. And that group we've met so far, Yodei Ha'itim, They're the political advisors. They know the times. We've met Yodei Dasvadin, the legal team. They know all the laws. Who then is referred to in Pasuk Yud Dalet? Va'korev elav, you have these seven people. Karshina Sheshad, Marshatarshish, Meres Marsina, Memuchan. Memuchan is number seven on that list. And who are they? What panel do they belong to? What team are they? How are they described? They are described as Shiba Sarei Parasu Madai. They're nobles. Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, they see the king. Hayoshim Rishonim B'Malchus, they sit first in the kingdom. So do they belong to the first team, the first committee, the second committee? The answer, says Yosef Lechach, is they don't belong to any committee. Their job is not to advise the king. Their job is literally as described in these verses. Namely, they are the king's entourage. What are their qualifications? Being noble. And what is their job? To be noble. And what does that mean practically? They need to sit there and go, ooh and ah. Whenever the king does something, they look at the king. There is they are the equivalent of human furniture. And no one ever talks to them because they don't really have any expertise. No one asks them questions. That's not their job. And that really is the full impact of what is happening in this tribunal for Vashti. Namely, Ahasuerush consults with two groups, and the only one who's prepared to speak up was actually the most junior member of the third group. And the third group was not officially consulted because they have no expertise. But Memuchan feels that he needs to speak up. And that is why when he starts to speak in Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayomer Memuchan, Memuchan says, Lifnei HaMelech Bahasarim, he starts to speak before all of them. The Pasuk doesn't say Vaya'an Memuchan. Achashverosh asked a question. If a question was asked and you're responding, so then you're answering. Why does it not say Vaya'an Memuchan, but rather Vayomer Memuchan? He said, because, says Yosef Lekach, no one asked him. No one put the question to him. He's just meant to observe. But he spoke up anyway. And there's many possibilities as to why he did that. Why does Haman feel that Vashti should be killed? Some say that he wanted his daughter to marry Ahasuerus. Others say that he had his own issues with Zeresh, with his wife, which is not exactly hard to believe. And therefore, if a precedent is set whereby Vashti disobeyed the king, it's going to lead him even to more trouble at home with Zeresh. And therefore, he wants to use Vashti to set an example that his own wife should toe the line. Whether or not that happened, I actually have no idea. Bichlal, I think Zeresh is generally underrated as a force of evil in the Purim story. She's not given enough credit, I don't think. But she's the one that eggs Haman on. And I've never seen people lobby for more recognition of Zeresh as the as a prominent figure within the Haman household. But it certainly should be recognized. No vexation without representation. And so, what is it that Haman says? He really is about to present this whole episode in a way which by the time he's finished, Ahasuerus will have no choice but to do what he says. It is an amazing exercise in a manipulation of the paranoia and insecurity of Ahasuerus. How does it go? Basically, in brief, if we would describe it, what he's saying is that when people hear about this party that you set up, you have invested half a year in the first party and this one in order to establish yourself as king. If you don't take firm action here, you will have achieved exactly the opposite. And let us see how the psukim go. So Achashverosh first, so Haman Memuchan, we'll call him. Firstly, he says this is not just about the king. Lo al ha-melech levado. This, it starts with you, but it doesn't end with you. This is a strike against all men in your kingdom. Ki al kol ha-sarim, v'al kol ha-amim, asher b'chol medinot ha-melech Achashverosh. Now, the question is, how will this disintegration work? We should remember, different people, or people in the different parties, are privy to different amount of knowledge as what exactly happened. By which we mean, in the men's party, they only know one thing. Namely, Vashti was summoned, she didn't turn up. That they know that fact. More than that, they don't know. But in the women's party, they know more than that. Because Vashti, we must suspect, was vocal. Achashverosh wants to keep the insult under wraps. But Vashti, we have to assume, is very vocal. And she says, he's a nobody, I'm the king. And therefore, when everyone leaves the party, the husbands and wives will reunite. And they'll compare notes about what they know. And the men will tell the story from their side, but nothing will prepare them for what's waiting from the women's side. The men's side is in Pasuk Yud Zayin. Ki yetzei dvar malkah al kol hanoshim. When the matter gets out about what the queen did, lavzos balihen be'enehen, it will lead them to degrade their husbands. Be'amram. The men at the end, this is the men talking, and the men will say what they know. But what do they know? They have limited information. They know one thing. HaMelech HaChashverosh Amar Lahavi Es Vashti Amalka Lefanav Velo Va'a. He called for her, she didn't come. It's a shanda, it's a terrible thing. And then Pasuk Yud Ches says, the wives will tell them, you don't know the half of it. If you would have heard what we heard, that's nothing. She didn't just refuse. Pasuk Yud Ches, Vahayom Hazeh, on this very day, when everyone reunites, husbands and wives, Tomarna Saros Parasu Madai, the noble women of Parasu Madai, Asher Shom Ues Devar Hamalka, they heard what she said. They heard her insults. Not just that she refuses, she is demeaning the king. L'chosar Yamelech, they will tell that to all the noblemen. And the result will be Uchedai Bizayon Vakatsef. It will be ample Bizayon, degradation, and Ketsef. Again, is that word anger. The question is degradation of whom? And anger by whom? And against whom? What Haman is saying is all the husbands will now be degraded. And there will all, that will lead them to be angry at you. Because you were the one who could have stopped it. And if your goal in making this party was to establish yourself as leader, all you will have done and all of your efforts will have resulted in nothing more than national anger against you. And by that time, Achashverosh, whose insecurity led him to move the center of the kingdom, is effectively reduced to a blithering mass he's helpless now. And now Haman offers him a way out. The first thing they need to do, and let us see how the pasuk reads. Imal ha-melech tov. If it's good for the king, and of course by this stage, it's very good for the king, whatever Memuchan says. Let a royal decree go for him. Let it be written in the laws of Paras. Vashti shall not come before Achashverosh. That needs to be done now. What is happening here? It's actually quite a frightening thing. Haman is looking to spread a counter-narrative to what actually happened. In other words, we remember, all the men know, and all that they know, more correctly, is that she didn't turn up, but they don't know why. Of course, they somehow remember that she was meant to turn up and she didn't turn up. And as far as they're concerned, she must have refused. Says Haman, no. We need to issue a counter-narrative to that, a different spin. We need to revise and rewrite that whole situation. Let the word go forth and let it be known, Vashti is not allowed to appear before Ahasuerus, and get that into people's consciousness, get that into their lexicon. That way, when the women tell their husbands that Vashti says she's not coming, the husbands will be ready and say, no, I think you got it wrong. She didn't refuse. Ahasuerus did not allow her to appear before him. She may have then turned it into a refusal. And before you look around, you have two truths. And whoever says their truth louder is the truer. And that's the first thing. So there's a complete revision of this whole episode. Let history show that Vashti was not allowed to come to Ahasuerus's feast. The pasuk doesn't actually describe openly whatever happened. As we know, she was done away with, and Ahasuerus needs a new queen. But there is a further point. Namely, the opening words of pasuk Yotes, Im halamelech tov, yetzed v'malchus milfanov, that a royal decree go forward, v'yikasei b'dasei farasum adai, v'lo yavor, let it be written. And what is dasei? Das means a constitution. That is very interesting. Let it be written into the constitution of Paras Umadai that Vashti can't come to Ahasuerus. Well, it doesn't seem to be the type of thing that deserves to be in the constitution. The constitution are the ongoing laws. I mean, Vashti is going to be finished by the end of the day. It's hardly something, it's not worth the ink to write it into the constitution. I mean, what's it going to look like? The constitution is every man is entitled to this, he's entitled to bear arms, he's entitled to an attorney, he's entitled to remain silent, and Vashti can't come to Ahasuerus. It doesn't, that's not the stuff of which a constitution is made. But the truth of the matter is, and this is one of the major themes now of the Yosef Lekach, is that there is something that deserves to be written in the constitution. Because Haman is not just suggesting a solution to Ahasuerus, he is proposing a new type of law. And that law is what's referred to in Pasuk Yotes as Devar Malchus, a royal decree. What do we mean to say? We see from earlier Psukim that Ahasuerus is basically surrounded by committees. It seems like he can't really make a decision about anything without consulting with experts, even in something that was done to him seemingly. And what Haman offers Ahasuerus is a certain power. Namely, if something relates to the king himself primarily, the king himself can decide how to deal with it. He's offering Ahasuerus freedom, in a sense, from all these committees. And everyone is delighted by this. Ahasuerus is delighted because he's never had this power before. Everyone else is delighted because they don't want to be the ones to make the decisions for these things. They let Ahasuerus make the decision because if they're it could always rebound on them. No one wants to tell Ahasuerus to kill Vashti, because tomorrow he'll forget why and then he'll kill them. And therefore, better let the king decide. Who can he be angry about? Himself? Okay. Everyone's happy. And that's why this law, says Memuchan, should be written bidasei furasomadai, it should be written into the constitution. Because it is an amendment to the constitution, as per this landmark case of Ahasuerus versus Vashti. A new idea called Devar Malchus, says the pasuk. Everyone loved it. Vayitav hadavar be'enei hamelech v'hasarim. And this idea of Devar Malchus, this new type of law, a royal edict that the king alone decides, is a theme now that will run through Megillas Esther. And in fact, the first time we see it express itself is actually in the beginning of the third perek of Megillas Esther. What happens there? That's when Haman finally makes his first appearance. If anyone can remember those early days, all dressed up, ready to cause noise, and the first two prokim, the Haman is not to be heard of. It's almost Tsar Bale Chai. Finally, he arrives on the beginning of chapter 3. Achar advar ma'ele, Haman promotes, Achashverosh promotes Haman. Achar hadvar ma'ele, after these matters. Which matters? Well, what comes just before the beginning of chapter 3? The end of chapter 2. And what's at the end of chapter 2? The whole conspiracy of Bigtan and Teresh. But let's review the events. Bigtan and Teresh want to kill the king for whatever reason. Mordechai overhears and uncovers the plot. He tells Esther, and Esther tells the king, and then they're dealt with. That is the episode of Bigtan and Teresh. Achar advar me'ele, Achashverosh gives a promotion to Haman. I mean, that doesn't seem to work in a straight line. If we could put ourselves in the mind of Achashverosh just for a moment, I mean, how does A lead to B? Bigtan and Teresh wanted to kill me. Mordechai found out. He told Esther. Esther told me. And now the thing to do, based on all that, is to promote Haman. I mean, that doesn't move in a straight line. I think you could call that the emperor's new logic, because it doesn't answer to what we're familiar with. But the truth is, says the Yosef Lekach, it was a direct consequence for a simple reason. Bigtan and Teresh wanted to kill Achashverosh, and now they've been caught. Now what to do? Well, it depends. Back in the day, Achashverosh would have had to get his committees together. Is the time right? Is it correct? What will happen here? None of that happened. They were just killed summarily by Achashverosh. Well, how was he able to do that? This is Dvar Malchus. They are plotting against him. He'll take action. Doesn't have to wake anyone up. Doesn't have to consult with anyone. This, we could say, is the first time that Achashverosh got to flex his Dvar Malchus muscles. And it felt good. And that's why he decided it's only correct to reward the one who had given him this power. That's Haman. And that's why Haman got a promotion based on Bigtan and Teresh, because Achashverosh wanted to thank him for giving him this idea called Dvar Malchus. Taking this further and moving into chapter 3, this really is part of what is behind Haman's plan to exterminate the Jewish people and the way that he thinks it will work. He says to Achashverosh, and he piles on the fact that they do not like the king. They do everyone else's laws. They don't do your laws. They're not worth anything. They're just degrading you. Why is he doing that? Because Haman wants his plan to go through this new channel that he created called Dvar Malchus. If it had to go through the committees, we can't assume that everyone on the committee would be okay with this. He wants to keep it between him and Achashverosh. But how can he do that? By making it between them and the king. And that's why he says, Imal HaMelech Tov, remember, you're the king. This is Dvar Malchus. They have it in for you. And therefore, if you decide to do away with them, you can. No one else needs to be consulted. That's how it goes through. In the end, of course, in the true spirit of Venafochu, this was the very law that got Haman killed. Because when things start to unravel for Haman, and they go from bad to worse, and it's on the day of the second feast, and he's been unmasked as the one behind the plot, and it's all going horribly wrong, the next person we hear from is Charvona. Charvona pipes up. And what does he say? He says, look, I can see the gallows that Haman made to hang Mordechai, asher diber tov al hamelech. Mordechai, who spoke so well in support of the king, and Haman wants to kill him. Vayomer hamelech teluhu alav. And the king said, hang him on that tree. What is Charvona saying? What's the great crime? He wants to kill Mordechai. Why is that such a great crime? Because Mordechai has been paraded through the town that day as the king's best friend. If he wants to kill Mordechai, and Mordechai is your best friend, that means there's something between him and you. And Achashverosh's ears perk up. Something between him and me? This sounds familiar. I know what to do in situations like this. He's a threat to me. Kill him. Back in the day, he wouldn't have been able to kill Haman, who is a senior minister in his kingdom, without once again consulting with all the committees. And Haman was on those committees. And there's a very good chance that he'd be able to somehow find his way out of it. But amazingly, Achashverosh doesn't need to consult any of those committees. Why not? Dvar Malchus. Where did that come from? From Haman. From Memuchan. And that's the element of the Nafochu. As if to say, the very constitutional amendment that he made to clear the way, first to get rid of Vashti, which cleared the way for Esther, in the end was what got him killed. They say, and it is said, Haman himself prepared the tree upon which he was hanged. We now understand that is as true constitutionally as it is true physically. He literally created the law that got himself killed in the end. These are elements which are yet to come, but we can see how all of this is being set up in the first parak of Megillas Esther, which hopefully has taken on new dimensions as we receive new insights through the guidance of the Yosef Lekach, beckoning us to pay as close attention as we can to the words, the phrases, the themes as they go through the parak. So we'll leave it over there for this evening. Mitzvah Hashem will pick up again next week as we continue our deliberations with regards to have a wonderful night and a great week.